Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hello, this podcast is made possible thanks to donations from listeners. And if you want to donate, just click one of the yellow PayPal buttons on my website. Also, subscriptions to the premium episodes also get funneled back into the show. So investing in Luke's English Podcast Premium is like investing in your English and also investing in the podcast at the same time. For more information, go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium info. You're listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk. Hello and welcome to the podcast. As a plane flies over the building, I don't know if you can hear that. Anyway, welcome back to the podcast. This is episode 671, and it's a free roaming conversation with Pete Smisson from Aussie English. Aussie English is a podcast and a YouTube channel about learning Australian English. And recently, Pete and I did a sort of podcast crossover YouTube thing where he interviewed me about my stuff, and then I did this interview with him for my podcast, which is what you're going to listen to now. This is also available as a YouTube video on my YouTube channel, so check it out there too. Some of you will be watching the video version. Pay attention, because there are differences actually between the video version and the audio version. There are subtle differences in some editing and also in the introduction and outro, so they are different. Anyway, you can find it the link in the show notes for this episode. You could try turning on the automatic subtitles if you are watching on YouTube. So this is quite a free-ranging conversation in which I talk to Pete about all things British and Australian, including swearing, teaching swearing to learners of English, swearing in a second language, accents and diversity of accents, accents in Australia and in the UK, football hooliganism in the UK and in Australia, removing statues of slave traders, COVID-19 in Australia, politics in the UK and Australia, bushfires, our ancestry, what Australia thinks of the UK and the USA, the Queen on Australian money, Australian English versus British English versus American English, class in the UK versus class in Australia, and then a few Aussie and British cliches. So that's loads of stuff, loads of sort of important, relevant topics, I think, when you get a conversation between an Australian person and a Brit. So that's it then. I hope you enjoy the conversation. For more information, visit my website, where you can also sign up for my premium service, of course. Also, check out Pete's channel, Aussie English, to see the interview that he did with me, which covered lots of stuff about swearing, particularly the C word for some reason. We devoted quite a long time to talking about the C word, and then some stuff about how I got started in podcasting and comedy. But now you can enjoy listening to a bit of Aussie English and some British English as we listen to this conversation now with Pete Smisson. And here we go. Okay, so I am now talking to Pete Smisson from Aussie English. Hello, Pete. How are you today?
I'm good, Luke. How are you going?
I'm fine, thank you. I've just been on your podcast, which was lots of fun. Thank you for inviting me.
Man, my pleasure. Thanks for coming on. And go check that episode out if you want to hear how Luke changed the trajectory of my life.
That's right, yeah. It's unbelievable, really. But yes, listen.
As well as probably, 100 C-bombs?
There were a lot of C-bombs dropped in that episode. But, you know, all for pedagogical reasons. I think we handled the subject in the appropriate manner. So hopefully people will be enlightened about how to use the C word.
It's a tough one, isn't it? I mean, and sorry to sort of hijack things, but how do you feel about teaching swearing in English? and your role doing that as an English teacher or as an English content creator, because I quite often get asked, you know, you should do more of it, or I'll get people saying you should never do any of it. And I'm kind of like, ugh, you know, it's a very hard spot to be in, right?
Yes, it can be a bit tricky, and it's sometimes a problem. But I personally believe in swearing. I believe in swearing.
No, I mean, I believe it's a thing.
I've heard it exists. No, and I believe in it as a concept. No, I mean, I believe in teaching swearing. I think that it's important because, well, lots of reasons. First of all, swear words are used. They're used all the time, every day. You just need to know when it's appropriate to use them and when it's not. And people hear swearing in all their favorite films and their music and stuff like that in conversations. So swearing is worth teaching people just for that reason, because it's part of the language. It can actually be interesting to, as a way into studying language actually through swearing, because, you know, when you take a word like the F word, you can actually explore all the many different ways in which it's used in a sentence, which kind of gives you a little window into the grammar of the English language. Actually, the word fuck is actually one of the most versatile words in the language, which is quite interesting. So there's a certain level of linguistic sophistication involved in swearing properly and understanding it all. But yes, it's problematic because obviously it can be rude. But I think if you teach it with certain statements like, you know, this is a rude language, but we're doing it because it's important to know it, but you probably shouldn't use it in these situations, then I think it's probably fine. But on the podcast, I sometimes find myself listening back to a conversation which has lots of swearing in it, and I feel a bit awkward, and I feel it's necessary to kind of say, you know you'll hear swearing, but you know, you might want to just be careful about swearing. I find that
my expression is always, if in doubt, go without, right? Like, if you don't know, if you're not comfortable, don't do it.
Yes.
It's a good thing to at least have heard it, understand how it's being used, because there is definitely a lot of miscommunication that can, you know, go across. The one in Australian English is, there's a big difference between being a mad cunt and being a cunt. Like, there's a big difference. You know, my best mate, he's a total mad cunt.
Yeah.
And this guy I don't know who just drove, you know, over my young child is a complete cunt.
Yeah, to say the least.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, sorry. We can drop, but leave that word alone now.
See, I always think in extreme cases like that, when I'm teaching, if I need to, you know, come up with something extreme, the furthest I will go is probably the death of a dog. That's usually the thing. So if you're talking about, you know, extremely sad feelings or tragic feelings, you know, if you have to describe grief or something, it's always that someone's dog has died. If it tends to be, you know, the more safe option rather than...
I meant that my dog is called Toddler.
So right. No. There you go.
Recovered.
We recovered it. What were we talking about just then? We were just talking about, I can't remember.
What was teaching swearing.
Yeah, teaching swearing. So I also enjoy it a lot as well, but I do, you know, it comes with a caveat, which is that, as you said, if in doubt, go without. So there are plenty of cases when it would be just really jarring and wrong to swear.
Well, the interesting thing is I was reading this book recently. I don't know if you can see it. It's called The Bilingual Brain. He was talking. Yeah, I'll grab it and I'll show you it. So it was really interesting because he was talking about how people learn obviously multiple languages, whether from birth or later on in life. And there was a part in there talking about swearing and how it doesn't ever hit home the same way in a foreign language you've learned later in life. Whereas when you learn it from birth, whatever language you've learned or languages, there's a very, very strong emotional attachment to the rude language that you learn. Whereas in a foreign language, it probably takes a very, very long time to develop that.
Yes, absolutely. So people can be a little bit sort of devil may care when they're swearing in English, if it's not their first language, because it doesn't have the same impact on them. So they're dropping the F-bomb and the S-bomb. Shit, it's not. Anyway, and so they don't realize how badly it can kind of come across, especially if you, I have to say, unless you're swearing perfectly, it's going to sound terrible. So you've got to get it absolutely right, or it will just sound appalling. Like if someone says, "Hey, what, are you shitting me off?" It's like,
yes.
"No, that sounds no, no." So you have to get it right.
There's a cliche in Australia, I think, with the Indian community, and a lot of them misusing it at the ends of sentences. So they'll say something like, you know, "You're really pissing me off, fucking."
Right.
And it completely changes the meaning of the phrase if you say "you're pissing me off, fucking."
Yeah, yeah, totally.
As opposed to "you're fucking pissing me off."
There's a fantastic comedian in the UK called Paul Chowdhury, and he's so funny. He's Indian. Well, he's British born, but I think he's of Indian background. But he does all of that stuff. He's like, you know, does lots of different accents, including sort of an Indian accent. And it's always "bastard." "You're pissing me off, bastard." It's really, really funny. And it's, you know, politically it's sort of sensitive because he's dealing with ethnic stuff. But he gets away
with it because he's part of the community, right?
Exactly. Yeah. But he also does it very well. It's not just that he's part of that community. He's also very, very good at doing it. He does English accents and stuff too. I mean, sort of like, you know, Cockney accents and things as well. So yes, swearing, teaching swearing. Yes. I mean, that goes back to what we were talking about in your video there. About the C
word.
Yeah,
exactly. But I'm definitely jealous of you guys in Britain because you can actually do a lot more with accents because you guys have such a diverse range of dialects of English across such a small island, no offense, but
yeah, it is.
Compared to Australia, which is pretty dialectically poor, I would say. We've got probably three. I mean, the trope is that we have three accents. We've got like the upper class Australian accent, which is, you know, received pronunciation British. It's a cultivated English. Then we have the general, which I would claim to have, the general accent. And then we have the, you know, the really rural accent where, you know, we have this much more nasally thing going on and longer vowels and, you know, so it's a lot more drawn out.
Yeah.
And it's not geographic, like you guys are so, you know, there's little pockets with these really distinct dialects.
Yeah.
And in Australia, it's more cultivated, are going to be rich, you know, toffs in the big cities. The general's kind of everywhere in sort of suburban areas. And then the rural areas will be the, you know, "How's it going? What's going on, Sandra?" that sort of, you know, stereotype. Again, it's not absolute.
Yeah.
But we don't have like you can go from Perth on one side of the continent, 4,000 or 5,000 kilometres to the other side, and it's effectively the same accent.
Wow, because in England, it's like totally the opposite. So it sounds like in Australia, it's either a sort of class-based thing or it's a sort of rural to metropolitan thing.
I think it's more that. I felt my accent. I live in a town called Ocean Grove, which is actually about an hour and a half away from Melbourne. But when I moved to Melbourne to get educated at university after high school, I found my accent became closer to generally cultivated kind of area, a little more, you know, metropolitan, easier to understand because there are so many foreign people that live in Melbourne and you couldn't get away with, you know, using too much slang or having a ridiculously difficult accent because no one would understand you. You have to repeat yourself all the time and it eventually wears away and you stop doing that.
Yeah.
But it wears off. When I went to Queensland, which is in the north, and they're kind of the, I guess they're kind of like the Australian rednecks, you know, we pay them out. We make fun of them for that. Mm-hmm. So they have a stronger accent sometimes, but they say things like, you know, it's a pretty hot day today. Hey, or, you know, did you want to go out? Hey, like, what do you reckon?
Yeah, I've heard that. Yeah.
They put all this stuff at the end of sentences.
Hey.
And I started doing it after a few weeks. And I was like, damn it. You know, like, why am I doing this? I've worked for years to have my posher Australian accent. And it's just in-group preference, right? You start hanging out with a group of people. You start sounding like them. So I think that's as well in rural areas. You'll end up with, you know, loads of blokes working in industry, working on a farm together, and they end up with stronger accents. And so it'll be the same thing. You meet tradies who are tradesmen working in Australia. They're going to have more sort of what we call bogan kind of accents, lower class, like uneducated accent in quotation marks. Mm-hmm. But it tends to be because they're around those people all day, every day.
Yes.
even though they live in a town, you know, potentially with lots of immigrants or, you know, so it is really funny how that stuff evolves.
Whereas, and that's not regional, as you said, so it could be from both sides of the country, that distinction is going to be the same. Whereas in the UK, it's like utterly regional, but it's also class-based. So in terms of the regional stuff, the example that, you know, we usually give in this situation is Liverpool and Manchester. And they are literally 30 minutes away from each other by car. And the accents are really different. So, Liverpool, they're sort of saying like this, all right, mate, do you want a cup of tea? And then Manchester, it's like more like that. Like, all right, I'm from Manchester. Like, all right, I'm from fucking Oasis, man. You know what I mean?
There's an amazing video of a girl and she's like, my daddy was, he was pretending to be a monkey and he was eating onions and he was.
Oh, that's the video of the girl who's got a Yorkshire accent.
What do you like most about daddy?
You know, when he was taller, and he didn't juggle anymore. He just lay down in bed, put one arm up, and then rolled down like a monkey.
Did he?
Yeah,
he was pretending to be a monkey and he had all these onions.
I had to listen to it probably like 10 times before I got what was going on, but I was like, this is just the most adorable thing ever. But it goes to show how quickly those accents are locked onto, right, by children in well, probably anywhere. But it's crazy that they're still maintained in Britain because you guys have social media, you have public transport, you know, you have planes, you have buses, people move around, but you guys still seem to develop these accents and hold on to them for the rest of your lives.
It's
right?
largely due to a sense of community and, you know, the idea of accommodation theory, which is that you accommodate to the people who you identify with. So let's say if you are from Liverpool and you support Liverpool or Everton football clubs and, you know, you are a Scouser, then you're going to accommodate to the other Scousers. I mean, largely because they live all around you, but also because that's your identity. And so you're going to accommodate to that accent. Similarly to when you move somewhere, you accommodate to that accent. Your accent changes a bit. So when I was living and working in Japan, I worked with a lot of Australian people and I started accommodating to Australian English. And when I came home, my friends told me that I was going up at the end of every sentence. Like that, which is kind of an Aussie thing to an extent. So accommodation. And so, because Liverpool and Manchester have got such strong cultural identities, you know, people, the accent as a result is very pronounced. And certainly there's a huge rivalry between the two towns, especially in football. Fierce.
It's so weird how you guys have, we still have Australian rules football. We have soccer as well, which we call soccer. We have rugby too, which can be called football, depending on where you live in Australia. And I don't know where you ever have two supporter bases get together and fight. I've never heard of brawls breaking out over football teams or rugby teams or soccer teams in Australia, but I know that it's a big thing in the UK. You guys take your soccer seriously,
Wait,
right?
So you guys, when you go to see some Aussie rules game and it's two rival teams and everyone's getting tanked up on Castlemaine 4X, which you probably
I'm sure there are.
Do you have Castlemaine 4X?
I steer clear of that. We've got 4X. That's Queensland beer, though. That's like cat piss.
It's actually Castlemaine 4X. I mentioned that because it's a massive cliche in the UK about Australia. There was this series of adverts for Castlemaine 4X. This Australian beer, and it was like two guys in the outback getting up to no good, getting into accidents, meeting crocodiles and stuff.
Happens on a daily basis.
And at the end, it's like, I could do with a Castlemaine 4X, mate. It's kind of like the way that every advert ends. So that's
We used to have one for VB, which is Victorian Bitter, my state, Victorian Bitter. And it would be, and it'd have this like, you can get it working up a sweat. You can get it, you know, writing a note. You can get it working with a tie. Matter of fact, I got it now. VB. And it used to be all these different people working and then they'd all be like smashing pints of VB at the pub afterwards. But
stay
away from that stuff.
We could talk about the sort of slight cliches of Australia that we have in the UK and where they've come from. But we were talking about
accents in Britain. Yeah, dialects.
And accommodating, and football, that's it. And I wanted to know, so when guys get together and watch some sort of game, big game, they don't get drunk and fight each other? You don't get football fans fighting?
I think you would have it on maybe individual level, but you would never have it on the broad scale that at least I hear occurs in, yes, in places like Manchester, where you guys will have knife fights, you know, it's like it gets full on, you know. I've heard that, I'm sure violence is here as well. I'm sure we're no different, but it's interesting that you guys have such strong rivalries.
Yeah.
And I don't know if soccer or football is an excuse for the fighting to just take place anyway, right?
Yeah, but it totally is.
it totally is.
I mean, genuinely, what's their reason for fighting with each other? There's no reason at all. There's absolutely no reason.
Dude, your team won. Take the knife out of my chest. Like, you won.
Like, the whole competition has already been decided on the football pitch, you know. So, yeah. Of course, they're totally using football as an excuse to just have a good old fight. And I don't know why. It's just blokes of a certain age, a certain type of guys who are violent people, and they have violence in their lives, and they like drinking, and that's how they express themselves, is through violence. But yes, there is a lot of it in the UK. I mean, recently we saw, you know, we've been seeing violence on the streets. Quite often we have riots and public unrest, fighting with the police and things like that. So it's not just relating to football, but yes, there is a lot more hooliganism in the UK, and not in Australia. But is that because in Australia, yes, it's just everything's chilled out, everyone's laid back? What's the reason?
We have different issues. So,
yeah.
I mean, we still have hooliganism, you would say. There were some race riots that we had here, the Cronulla riots in Sydney a few years back, where I can't remember the specifics because I live in a different city, but effectively what you had was a whole lot of white nationalists, Australians get together and be very racist. And then as a result, in the evening, you had a lot of Lebanese and Arab groups get together as well. And they were being very violent. So we still have that sort of tribal violence at times. I guess it's just a different flavor. It's a similar thing, though.
Yeah, you have that too. So that's going on in many places, in the States, of course, as we know, and in the UK as well. It's a pretty messed up situation. You know, for example, you got people recently pulled down a statue of a slave.
Did it learn to swim?
No, it sank to the bottom.
Like a stone.
In dramatic fashion. They pulled down.
How do you feel about that? This is going on all over the place, and it's starting to shit me. Because I'm like, erasing history doesn't change our current problems, right? Like, it's not, I understand we're not, but who was passing these statues and worshipping them in the first place, right? They were erected hundreds of years ago. I don't think anyone knows what the statue is, who it is, until these sorts of issues arise.
I think people do know what the statues are, and it's written.
Really?
The name of the person is written on the statue.
Yeah. But I mean, how often do they go up, look at it, and, you know, really scrutinize? Because I mean, in Melbourne, where I live, there's hundreds of those things all around the place. And I mean, unless you were to specifically go up and actually read about it, learn about it, you're not going to really know that much about every single one of these statues. So, and it seems like everyone becomes an expert later on when there's problems like this, and they're like, these are the problematic ones, we need to tear them down.
Yeah. It's tricky. I mean, Bristol is a city in the southwest of England that was largely built on the slave trade, it has to be said. That was other things, other industries too, but largely that. And so the money that came from, I mean, the slave trade is, we know, is a seriously bad thing. Like, one of the worst things that you can do is enslave other people. I mean, it's, you know, it's like epically bad in a kind of Lord of the Ringsian kind of way, you know, like proper evil shit that, you know, we have basic human rights, and it's like, it violates every aspect of that. I don't know. I find it to be,
it's tough.
I understand.
It's tough.
And yet at the same time, you know, he did perhaps contribute to building the city as it is. And
it's one of those things where I don't think we necessarily need to be worshipping the individual. I think, you know, there's nothing wrong with chucking a disclaimer on it. The thing that I fear is forgetting the past. And if we whitewash everything by removing the untasteful stuff that effectively gets us to have a conversation about issues in the past, we lose those talking points, right? I think you would be better served by leaving that statue there and having a big sign in front of it saying, this piece of shit owned slaves, you know, yeah, or like maybe. Just being a constant reminder of that issue, that it still was part of the past.
It's a bit weird. But imagine the statue there, and it's like, here is a bronze statue of this person on a horse. And it's like, this guy, you know, kept loads of slaves. Ta-da! Here he is. It still doesn't seem to ring true. I mean,
the trouble, though, is that it's a very nuanced argument, because there are so many different statues about different people who had different levels of, you know, and we're using today's standards to measure on them. I mean, you have people like Alex the Conqueror, Alexander the Great, sorry, and all these other people in history where they were heroes on one side, but absolutely horrible mass murderers on another.
Yeah, and do you tear down the statue of Churchill in Whitehall? I mean, do we go that far?
I assume people want to at the moment.
There are some people who do, because, you know, arguably, I mean, obviously the thing about Churchill is, I mean, arguably he was a racist, and you can see a lot of the policies that he put through, you know, showed that. And this is what a lot of people are saying. But on the other hand, he defeated Hitler in inverted commas. So it's a very tricky thing. Like, yeah, he was like the best racist. One of the best, anyway, I think. You see what I mean?
The best racists.
You know, I'm being glib about that, but you know what I mean. One of the most sort of successful. I don't know. Anyway, but I don't think taking down a statue is erasing history, because statues are not there to educate us about the past so much as just a kind of, I don't know. I suppose it is about history, but no one's talking about erasing the history books. No one is talking about, like covering up the fact that these people did these things, because obviously we need to remember that. So no one's talking about erasing bad things from history. It's just whether it's appropriate to have a statue of the guy there when, you know, when everyone is just equal in society today. And it seems
maybe
a bit
they just
offensive.
Need to move it into a. Move it into a museum then, right?
Yeah, no one's talking about shutting down Wikipedia or closing the museums or burning the history books. There's none of that sort of thing going on. And I think it's disingenuous, in fact, to even suggest that it's a sort of, you know, you get arguments to say that taking down a statue is a sort of an act of fascism in itself, because it's sort of excessive control over things. But I think that it's not, actually, because it's not about literally erasing history.
The reason I get touchy about it isn't, this is sort of an extreme example, I guess, with the slave trader in, was it Liverpool or Bristol?
Bristol,
sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, in Australia, they're trying to do it with people like Macquarie and Cook behind me here, who, again, I mean, he quote-unquote discovered Australia. He obviously didn't, but in terms of, for the British, but then he went on his merry way. Like, he had very little to do with Australian history, and to, you know, he still had a role. And when you read his journals, when you read his diaries, he did have racist views to some extent, thinking, you know, I'm civilized, I'm better than everyone. But at the same time, he shows a lot of restraint in his interactions, which is why he ends up dying in the water in, you know, Hawaii, being killed, because he was, you know, not just wiping people out. So I don't know. I like that we're talking about it at least. But I get a bit touchy if everyone starts saying any white male statue needs to come down.
No, it's not any white male statue. I mean, it's obviously not any white male statue. It's this particular
I'm being facetious.
This particular slave trader.
That's a good example. That one is a good example, I guess, of one that you could argue on. But I think ones like Cook and like Macquarie is probably a better example, who was a governor in Australia. He had issues. He did certain things. But at the same time, you know, I think just raise other statues of other important people who aren't currently, you know, represented. You know, raise a statue of an Indigenous person or an African person who's
surrounded by statues everywhere.
yeah, that's it. Just drown him out. Whatever.
I know it's a complicated one, isn't it? Should we judge people in the past by today's standards? It's a difficult question to deal with. But you know, I think that judging people in the past having a statue up in the main Dockland area is, I don't know, it's an interesting debate. It's good that people are talking about it, even if people are also getting very, very angry about it and stuff, and lots of problems. But it does mean that people are talking about these things, at least.
And that's the most important thing, I think, to come out of the Black Lives Movement, and that's coming into Britain, it's coming into Australia as well. I just hope that a lot of people end up opening dialogue and wanting to talk about these things and getting into the nuance, because I feel like a lot of it gets missed and it ends up becoming very ideological and extremist on both sides. You know, you'll get the conservatives being like, you know, these colored people are trying to take control, and you'll get nut jobs on the other side saying we need to abolish the police because all they do is kill black people. And you're kind of like, can we just have a conversation about this openly and try and get to the root of the cause of your issues and try and, you know, make sure that everyone has equal opportunity and there isn't any discrimination or racism?
I know.
Extremism on either side is not good, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it's all very kind of complicated. So we ended up talking about the politics stuff. This is actually supposed to be my episode of the podcast here, and it's kind of gone wildly in various directions.
We can keep going for a bit if you've got some other questions that you want to chuck at me. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. So I was wondering actually what's going on in Australia at the moment regarding COVID-19 then? Are you guys living in lockdown?
I think they cracked down a little after New Zealand cracked down. So New Zealand went bonkers. They kind of went just straight out the bat. They were banning Chinese, transport coming into New Zealand. And I remember seeing that in the news and being like, whoa, shit. Like that's full on. That felt like, whoa, that's a little racist. And then Australia a few days later did it, and then the rest of the world did it, you know, at their different times. Australia, I think we lost about 100 people. I think it's 103, maybe 104.
That's not a lot. That is not very many. That's it in total.
I know you guys were putting us to shame.
We're the best in the world. We are the best in the world at mismanaging the COVID-19 crisis.
I don't know exactly what happened with Britain and why you guys had such a high rate. I think you may have just closed down too late after it had sort of spread. I think we got a hold on it and we were going nuts with testing as much as possible. And they ran a lot of social distancing campaigns, ads. They closed down businesses really quickly. They had a lot of restrictions everywhere. And so everyone was pretty much inside for a long time. I didn't see my parents, who live about 100 meters away from me, for over a month because my dad had heart issues, and he was like, everyone stay the fuck away. So, yeah.
In the UK, it was basically 2 weeks of Boris going, bah, Boris, you know, COVID-19, I've been shaking people's hands. You know, he spent...
Someone hand me a comb.
two weeks of, not doing anything in the UK. At least 2 weeks of flapping around, doing U-turns. COVID's it's easily manageable, and that kind of thing. And then 2 weeks later, stay inside, protect the NHS, save lives is what.
And he got it. He almost died, right? He ended up in ICU, didn't he?
We don't know to what extent his health was in danger. They did say he went to the intensive care unit, but I don't know if that means that they were like, you know, clear, beep, you know, like. The defibrillators and stuff. I don't know if it was that much, but
do you reckon? I reckon that when Boris, if he took his shirt off, it just has this huge "Do not resuscitate." You know, like I can imagine that he's just like covered in tats underneath the shirt, just like goth as.
I don't know. There is a. Oh God, what a person we've got there. So anyway, a very late response and lots of flapping around regarding testing and getting that wrong and lots of lying and incompetence in government. It's unbelievable. We've got an incredibly incompetent lot at the moment. And
is there a lot of anger in the public now as a result of the handling?
Yeah. Boris Johnson has lost popularity across the board as a result of this. He's got his fans. He's got the people who are just convinced that he's the greatest thing and he's going to make Britain great again and that sort of thing. But among conservatives, you know, people have looked at the situation and seen that it's been pretty poorly managed. I mean, just their PR stuff, the way they talk to the press, it's not like they're being, well, obviously they are showing contempt in the sense that they tell untruths and it's kind of quite well known, but also in the sense that they just seem to be so ill-prepared and getting things wrong and just making mistakes and things. So it's just... You know, it doesn't feel like the country's in very safe hands. And we've got Brexit coming up.
So. We had the inverse sort of happen here in Australia where we'd just gone through those bushfires, right? And our Prime Minister was in Hawaii enjoying a holiday just as shit got real and copped a massive amount of flack for that. So he burnt through all of his political capital.
During the bushfires?
Yeah, he came back and was, oh man, it was just a complete, you know, joke. He went to one of the worst hit towns that had had a number of people die there and was trying to get a photo up, you know, just walking around and trying to shake people's hands. And they were like, I don't want to shake your hand. Get away from me. Don't touch me. And he was like forcing his hand into theirs and being like, thank you. Awkward. And then getting photos and then going on to the next person. And we were just like, that was on TV. So there were cameras following him showing that happening.
Yeah.
And so at the end of that, he had nosedived, but then COVID happened. And as a result of his somewhat competent handling of it, although there's been quite a few issues, I think he's gained a lot of it back. So, unfortunately, we might have our current Prime Minister around for a while.
So, he's what kind of administration do you have there? What's the Prime Minister like?
He'd be similar to, I think, Boris in terms of, well, and again, I'm not a political expert in Australia, but he's in the Liberal Party, which is the conservative party in Australia, you know, fiscally conservative. He is a very religious man. He's a Pentecostal Christian. He tends to keep that to himself, which is probably a good thing. But he's just he's a marketer as well. Originally he was in marketing. So he runs all these stunts when he has a bad run, and we call him Scotty from marketing. And he, you know, like when he first became prime minister, he decided to call himself ScoMo, as in his name is Scott Morrison. He gave himself a nickname, ScoMo, which is something you do not do in probably British culture, but Australian culture as well. You do not give yourself a nickname. Other people give you a nickname. So we started calling him ScoMo instead or Smoko. And Smoko, because Smoko in Australian slang is where you go for a break to smoke a cigarette for 5 minutes. When he went to Hawaii, he took a Smoko, or he did a ScoMo. You know?
Yeah, I see.
So he's copped a lot of flack in Australia recently. But yeah, who knows where that's going to go. Okay. The world is in a quite a state.
It is, isn't it? I just wish the whole thing would just calm down. We just go back to the 80s again, when it was Star Wars figures and tape recorders. I mean, there's lots of other things I could talk to you about, but we shouldn't let this too long. I'm going to ask you some more stuff. Okay.
I'm an open book, man. Go for it.
So, let's see. Have you ever been to the UK?
No, I've been to France. I've been to Paris. That's as close as I believe I've ever been to the homeland. So I have my parents do their DNA test for ancestry. Mm-hmm. And actually, it turns out my parents are into their family history stuff. And it turns out I'm related to the royal family. So I must be like, I don't know, billionth in line for the throne or something.
Really?
I don't think it's a current royal family. I think it is like Alfred. Like when we go really far back, right? Oh, King of Wessex.
Yes.
Alfred.
Okay. So
and through to Charlemagne as well in France.
So you're English with some French in there too?
It'll go back to that family because of the Norman. Royal family relations. But I think primarily, yeah, my dad is Scottish British and my mom is pretty much British. So when you look at our DNA, it's pretty much all in Britain. And then there's a bit of East Germanic.
So either you're Norman or you are, yeah, sort of Anglo-Saxon. If it's Germanic, exactly. It would be like Danish or something like that.
But it is pretty weird. It is pretty weird. I don't know. Growing up in Australia, you have this identity that you're Australian, but at the same time, I know that at least genetically speaking, I am British. You know, my ancestors are mostly from around Yorkshire, I think, as well as, you know, London.
That's where my parents are from, Yorkshire. Up north in Yorkshire.
It was so crazy, man. I did an interview recently. I had a guy come past and he had to fix our chimney here in the house we're renting, and he had a Yorkshire accent, and he came in and I was just like, whoa, like, Jesus, you're fresh off the boat, mate. Like, where did this come from? We never hear these accents in Australia. And he's just like, you know, I can't even do the accent, but he was like, you know, I've been here for 10 years my whole family's been chimney sweeps for the last 250 years. I just kept going, you know, came to Australia, and he was just telling me all these amazing stories. And it was just crazy because I was like, I've got relatives from Yorkshire if you go back, you know, so we could be related, who knows. But it was interesting, in our episode we were talking about dialects, I think, right? Maybe we're talking about them in this one.
I think it was this one.
This one, maybe. Yeah, sorry. And he was saying before he met his wife at the age of 20, I think it was in his late 20s, he hadn't been 40 kilometers out of Yorkshire.
Whoa.
Like he hadn't been to where she was from. It was Chadston or something like that, where it was like literally you could throw a rock and it would have, you know, passed from one town to the next, and he hadn't gone that far.
It's like that moment in Lord of the Rings when Sam Gamgee leaves the Shire.
You know, it's the furthest
I've been from Yorkshire in my whole life.
But it blew my mind because, yeah. I mean, and I'm sure there are people like that in Australia as well, where they just never leave wherever. But because it's such a big place and we're so used to kind of camping and you'll drive, you know, 500 kilometers to go to your camping spot, we're so used to going around all over the place. And he was just like, until I decided to come to Australia, I'd never left I've never left Britain, and I hadn't before that. I'd barely left Yorkshire. So it was really interesting. And he was just like, now I live here with my whole family and, you know, we're never going back. So,
so wow, you call England, I mean, maybe jokingly, or Britain, the home, yes. The homeland.
I'm taking the piss.
You're taking the piss. Yeah.
Or taking the mickey. There we go. We've got some rhyming slang.
Right.
Cockney rhyming slang.
Taking the mickey, yeah. So what is the relationship? What do Australians think of the UK these days? How do you view the UK when you look over there?
It's interesting. I don't know. We don't see you guys like America. You know, we would see Americans, I think, probably like you see Americans, where the edges tend to be pretty good and the center doesn't. You know, mm-hmm. like there's that kind of like the edges tend to be more like the rest of the world and the center tends to be very American.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I mean, the average American that you meet in Australia tends to be very well-traveled, very moderate in terms of what they believe and everything like that. And I think it would be the same with the British. The ones you would meet in Australia, as far as I know, tend to be very well-traveled, very interesting people. And mm-hmm. I don't know if we get like the wrong kind of interpretation then of what the average person in Britain is like, because the ones that we meet tend to be, and it's probably the inverse for you guys. You probably meet like the worst of our lot that we send overseas. You know,
get a lot of guys who
go on Contiki around Europe. Yeah. Sorry, Europe.
in London, I have to say the stereotype of the Australian is that he's a guy in flip-flops working in a bar somewhere in Shepherd's Bush or something.
Working on his winter tan, right?
Right, yeah. Still walking around in flip-flops.
I don't know. We don't really have a negative thing. We consume a lot of your TV. We tend to know a lot about your politics. So, I mean, like, I know Jeremy Corbyn. I know Boris Johnson. I know Tony Blair. I've been mm-hmm. following, you know, we get a lot of that media exported to us the same way as we know. The average Australian probably knows more about politics in Britain and America than Australia, because we see so much of it on the news. We hear about celebrities all the time from Britain. So we consume a lot of it. And I don't think we have very many negative, connotations. I think we tend to love it and find it really interesting, especially the fact that you guys have such an interesting history with the royal family. A lot of ancestry in Australia tends to have come from Great Britain, obviously through convicts. You guys have TV shows like Game of Thrones, which is so full of interesting dialects and accents and everything like that. So, yeah, I think we would have a pretty positive view. We do get the backpackers as well in Australia, which tend to be the negative side. Like you guys get the Australians, but really, to be honest, again, it's not that negative. It's just that you'll go to somewhere like Bondi Beach, and if you see anyone with a really bad suntan or really bad sunburn, you know instantly, yeah, they've just arrived from Britain. You know, like they did not realize that the Australian sun is brutal. in comparison.
What was I going to ask you? So you in Australia, you have the Queen on your money, on the banknotes.
Yes,
you have a picture of the Queen.
We do.
So, I mean, you know, do you look to the Queen as the figurehead then, your head of state?
We wouldn't really think about it. She's sort of not really, she doesn't really have that much to do with it, with us. A lot of us have a negative view of the royal family and think they're kind of, to be, you know, politically correct, just wankers. I mean, I don't know, Prince Charles, you see what Prince Andrew's been up to. I think some of them tend to be pretty cool, like the two sons, Harry and I've forgotten the older one.
William.
William, yeah. We tend to have a positive view of those two. Definitely the older generation, not as much. The Queen, she seems pretty, you know, nice as well. But the weird thing is you'll have groups in Australia that are obsessed with the royal family. And so they'll celebrate the weddings and they'll celebrate the... you know, the coming out of the Queen. They tend to be the older generation, I think, where maybe they were more, they more saw themselves as British when they were younger. Right. Like my grandparents received a, what was it? It would have been their 60th anniversary, wedding anniversary, and they received a letter from the Queen and it blew their minds. Like, wow. They were like, what? Yeah. So, and if we get, I think too, if we get over 100 years old, if you get over 100 years old, you get a letter from the Queen again. I don't know. Does she send herself a letter when she passes 100?
I've often asked myself that question, and I suppose the answer will be yes. But the Queen sends you a letter if you get to 100 here as well, which is obviously worth it, right? It's worth it just for the letter.
That's it. 100%. That was, you were like, well, I can give up now. Like, I made it.
Yeah.
But it is interesting having someone else's monarch on our money. You don't really think about it, though. It is on our coins and you kind of grow up with it. Just take it for granted. Take it for what it is. You see the different aged coins and you kind of see how she's aged. So there's a hotter version of the Queen on the coins from the 60s. And don't check out the ones from 2020.
Right. What about Australian English, British English, and American English? Do you think Australian English is closer to British English or closer to American English?
100%. Yeah. Really? 100%. 100%. Well, we are from you guys, right? You guys came out here. The interesting thing about our accent is that we had, when we were colonized by the British and they brought over effectively their, you know, their trash from the prison system that they didn't want to deal with, and, you know, a lot of whom were effectively slaves that had been imprisoned for unfair crimes, a lot of which were theft, you know, not anything too egregious. They were from all over different parts of Great Britain, mostly from around London, you know, and different, some of the nearby southern parts of Britain. And so they had a whole bunch of different accents and they all mixed together. And within, I think, the first generation or two, the accent had kind of completely changed from the parents, and as a result we got a lot of slang that was used, the flash language from the Cockney,
rhyming slang.
We got rhyming slang, although that died, to be honest. We don't really use that much more. That's kind of disappeared. My grandparents would have used it. I don't really use it unless I'm taking the piss, unless I'm saying something like pass me the dead horse, you know, to have on my pie or something. It's like it as a joke.
Dead horse sauce.
Tomato sauce. Yeah, tomato sauce. Exactly.
Yeah.
So we don't use it too much. But, we say things like bugger. We use that a lot. You know, oh, bugger me. You know, oh, bugger. And I know that came from you guys. There's a whole bunch of those sorts of things that we would use. Though you guys, as we were saying, twat, I don't think we got that. I think that must have evolved in Britain after we were colonized.
Yes, I guess so. Okay. But I mean, I guess grammatically and vocabulary wise, you know, there are certain differences. We see those images online of like, here are the British and American English. Australian English stuff tends to fall down on the British side of those things, doesn't
it? Yeah. So spelling wise, I think we're effectively the same as you guys. We haven't taken on the American spelling unless people are doing it accidentally, you know, like colour being C-O-L-O-R instead of O-U-R at the end.
Yes.
Though I think with some of the things like vegetables, like I wish I had them as props to kind of hold up. Yeah. But like we would say, I think eggplant instead of aubergine.
Yes.
You guys would say.
Yes, that's right.
Another one might be, I don't know, do you guys say cucumber?
Yes.
Okay. There's a few there that I know where you guys kind of move towards the French versions.
Do you call it a courgette or a zucchini?
Zucchini, 100%. Right. Yeah, so that's the Italian for us, I think, and you guys are using the French there.
Which is the same as American, that they say zucchini as well. Okay, some other things then, quickly, let me just test you. If you rolled up a piece of paper, you don't want it anymore, where do you put it?
You put it in the rubbish.
In the rubbish, but what is that container that contains the rubbish?
Rubbish bin.
The bin, all right, so not the trash can, but the rubbish bin.
I would never say trash can. I might say trash, chuck it in the trash, but again, I think that's American culture kind of bleeding in.
But it's a bin, not a trash can. Okay, that's an important one.
Yeah, no. It's
what about
bin.
Different parts of the car? What do you call the glass bit at the front of the car?
The windscreen.
Windscreen, same. So not windshield.
No, I would say windscreen. And the bonnet and the boot.
Right, same as in the UK. I think you're probably... Exactly. I think it's probably... probably the same then. I'm trying to think of other examples.
Well, I would say thongs. What do you think thongs are? I mean, I'm sure you know.
Yeah, thongs are what we call flip-flops.
Yeah.
Those things that you've put on your feet when you go down to the beach, flip-flops. Yep.
And I would say thong. G-string instead of a thong, which Americans would say for the very thin bather bottoms that women would wear.
Those very thin pants that reveal a lot of the bum on display.
I don't know if I'd call them pants, but...
It's a string, really. G-string, yeah.
Exactly.
Okay. So it seems that Australian English is more or less like British English. What about the pronunciation, though?
Well, it's very similar. It's very similar, but we don't use the glottal stop, so you won't hear butter. You know, that kind of stereotype, butter. We'll say butter. And so we use the T flap too. You won't hear butter or Peter.
But it's butter.
With the receipt.
Butter.
It's butter. Yeah, but butter, Peter.
It does sound like more American then, because it sounds more like a duh sound, butter.
Butter, yeah, butter. To some degree, yeah. So I think there are British accents, though, where that's come from.
What about R's in words? Like, how do you say...
The same as you guys.
Computer.
We use the linking R.
But how do you
computer.
Say... Computer. Right. So the point there is that it's interesting because some things sound a bit American, others sound British. So in the word computer, first of all, there's the T sound, which I say is computer, or another
computer.
English person might say computer. But you do it more like a D sound, computer.
T flap, computer.
T flap, which computer. Sort of makes it sound like a D, which is more like an American thing.
And I won't say the R unless there's a vowel after it, the computer riz on.
Yes, exactly. So that's the same as us. So in the word computer, there's an R at the end, but you don't hear me say it, computer, and it's the same for you, although you do the American T sound, I think, computer. So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. Also, there are sort of vowel sounds and so on. I mean, if I try to do an Australian accent, I don't know if it's really accurate, but if I try to do an Australian accent, it sort of sounds like this. I don't know if that's any good. There's also maybe
that sounds
a bit
New Zealand.
Yeah,
that sounds like a New Zealander
any
to
good.
Me.
But there, I don't know. Have you ever worked this out? Have you ever actually sort of worked out the key differences? Between my accent.
Well, it depends on which accent you're talking about in Britain, right? If it's just received pronunciation, it'd probably be those main differences, and then maybe a few of the vowels, the diphthongs in particular. We how would you say the word no? How would you say no?
That's a big one. No. Yeah. But you kind of it's almost like a y sound. No.
We push it to the front of the mouth a little more. So it's no, it's and I'm probably overdoing it. I would say like, yeah, I know a lot. No. But you would hear Australians say, no, don't stop. No.
Yeah.
So you will hear it really kind of accentuated there.
It sounds like there's more of a yeah in there. No.
Whereas, yeah, that you nailed it. You
for
nailed
me,
it.
It's
no.
More rounded.
And you almost have to bring the lips forward. Like,
I think it's the tongue. I think it's like your tongue as well. No. You, a bit of that in there.
You made it nasal too. That's good. It's nice and nasal. But, there's nasalness to a lot of the accents as well here.
G'day, a lot of nasal.
Exactly.
Yeah, g'day, mate. Yeah, I'm from...
How's it going?
I'm from Australia. Australia.
Another thing we'll do is that going. Like, you won't say going. You'll say going. Going.
How's it going? How you going, mate? Yeah.
How going. You going? Yeah, and you can drop the voice singing, how's it going?
Yeah, how you going, mate? G'day, mate. I do find that doing
that... Sounds like you're about to sell me some drugs or something.
Yeah, g'day, mate. Do you want to buy some of these? I do find that when I'm doing accents or voices, that it helps if I push more of a specific character, like make it into a more a unique voice. It helps to find the accent more easily. So even doing things like if you give yourself a speech impediment in the accent that you're trying to do, it can help. So if you're from Liverpool and you've got a little bit of a lisp like that, it sort of really helps the accent somehow. I don't know how it works, but it just makes it, much easier to do the accent when it's a sort of a person with even like a little speech impediment. Yes. So maybe going.
Do you get in trouble in Britain for doing accents like that? Has it come to that point yet?
You can. Obviously, some accents you'll get into trouble for. So if I did an Indian accent or probably a Jamaican accent.
I get that across races, I understand. But would you get in trouble for making fun of someone from Liverpool like that or Manchester?
If I was doing stand-up and I was in Liverpool and I did a Liverpool accent, I could easily get into trouble. But I'd get away with it if it was genuinely funny. So if it was genuinely funny, you'd be fine. They'd like it. But if you do a shit Liverpool accent, then they'll hate you for it.
They'll glass you.
And also, I mean, speaking like I do, I speak in this kind of BBC English voice. Oh, well, it's not like that. Yeah. I was pushing it there. You know, you can push the accent so you sound like a TV presenter. But I speak with this accent, this kind of received pronunciation. So if I go to Liverpool or Glasgow or Newcastle or something, and I go on stage,
that's an extra layer of
if I speak privilege to them with this voice, then they'll probably hate me a bit. So there's a bit of accent hatred that goes on, and we're all judging each other on our accents. Either we judge people as being working class or posh or unsophisticated or horrible or stupid sounding or irritating. We do judge each other all the time on our accents, and you open your mouth and people instantly work out certain things about who you are, where you're from, what kind of person you are, and they make an instant judgment based on the way you sound.
Well, and what else would you do, right? You've got all this information coming at you, and you want to, as a human being, sort of have as much of an interpretation of the person that you're dealing with. But it is interesting that you guys have much more of a class-based rivalry, I guess, things that are happening over there. I don't think you would have that as much here. And in fact, you will have a lot of the people in the quote-unquote upper class, like the Prime Minister, intentionally use language that makes him seem lower class, so that he's like, and we have this sort of tall poppy syndrome where we cut down the poppies that are too high in Australia, where it's like, you know, don't try and be too better than everyone, mate. You know, we're all Aussies, mate. And so we have this thing of kind of pulling everyone down to our, or at least wanting to be on the same level. Like, don't think, I get very uncomfortable when people think of me as, you know, like, oh, he's got money, or oh, you know, when I don't in reality, or you know, he's famous or whatever, and it's like, oh no, I'm just normal. So it is interesting, the class based stuff.
We sort of have that in the UK a little bit too. We take the piss out of each other to make sure we don't get too big for our boots.
Ricky Gervais is good at that, right? He's like, what does he say again? He's like, well, I've got loads of money. I mean, that's not his accent. I can't do anything else. But he's got like, I've got loads of money, but fuck, my body's fucked. I'm old. You don't want to be me. You just want my money. So
yeah, there's a lot of self-deprecation. You have to put yourself down a lot. You put yourself down, you put other people down, and it's just a way of kind of keeping everyone on the same level kind of thing. And also in, you know, politically as well, you'll find that newspapers build people up, and when they get to a certain point, they smash them back down again. But that's the press. That's our power-crazed press in the UK, which is slightly different. Pete, so we've had quite a good discussion here about all sorts of different things, a full-on ramble, which is normal on my podcast, actually. But so just briefly, tell us at the end here about where people can find you and about your podcast, Aussie English.
Exactly. You nailed it. Aussie is in A-U-S-S-I-E, short for Australian. You can find it on any good podcast application. Just search Aussie English or Australian English, and you'll find it at aussieenglish.com.au. So yeah, Facebook, YouTube, everywhere there. If you're interested in Australian culture, history, slang, news and current affairs, as well as, you know, wrapping your head around our interesting dialect down here, then go check it out.
Okay. Fantastic. Well, thank you for inviting me onto your show, and thank you for coming onto mine.
And, absolute pleasure.
It was lots of fun.
Definitely. Thank you. Okay, see you next time.
Yes, indeed. Okay. Cheers. So thanks again to Pete from Aussie English there. Check out the page on my website for this episode to check out links to his stuff. And don't forget to have a look at his YouTube channel to see his interview with me that we did on the same day. So to everyone on YouTube and on the podcast, that is it. It's basically time for me to say goodbye. This is episode what? Number 671. 671 episodes in. So to everyone on YouTube and on the podcast, it's just time for me to say goodbye. Bye, 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 bye. Thanks for listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus,
Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
If you enjoyed this episode of Luke's English Podcast, consider signing up for Luke's English Podcast Premium. You'll get regular premium episodes with stories, vocabulary, grammar, and pronunciation teaching from me, and the usual moments of humour and fun. Plus, with your subscription, you will be directly supporting my work and making this whole podcast project possible. For more information about Luke's English Podcast Premium, go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium info.